Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast. I'm Rachel Smith, COO with Exchange Wire. Delighted to introduce our guest this week in the studio, who is Maya Molsh, Deputy MD, Omnicom Media Group. I nearly stumbled over that. We rehearsed this and I nearly stumbled over it. Omnicom Media Group UK Programmatic. Yes. Hi, Maya.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Not at all. So glad that you could join us. And, of course, regular returned guest, Kieran O'Kane, CEO with ExchangeWire. How's it going over there, Kieran?
It's going wonderful, Rachel. Thank you. I have to apologise to Maya because I got her name wrong. Call her Mia.
It happens all the time.
It's a faux pas.
I blame my parents.
Well, people get my bloody name wrong. Call me Siron and Chiron.
I was going to say, you've really got something in common with quite a few of our Irish colleagues.
But I'm glad we got it back. I won't make that mistake again, Maya.
Okay, thanks.
And have you finished your Kit Kat there, Kieran?
I had a Kit Kat and I had a Baby Bell.
And, recording is happening during Kieran's afternoon snack break.
It's very important. Snackage is very important to keep powering through the day.
How the, you know, what goes on at Exchange Wire Towers? I'm sure listeners are fascinated.
They are massively fascinated.
Right. Well, let's launch into discussion of the first news story for this week that I wanted to have a chat with you guys about. This is an article that appeared in TechCrunch at the start of this week, focusing on Adobe teaming up with Amazon in their branded store environment. So branded stores are not new per se for Amazon. That's been available to Amazon sellers for a couple of years. But this partnership with Adobe is new. It's specifically aimed at sort of smaller merchants who've been selling on Amazon and probably other marketplaces as well, to help them build their own first-party commerce experience, but still being able to utilize some of the tools available to them in the Amazon environment. You know, arguably, I suppose it's giving Adobe an opportunity to get their suite of marketing tools out in front of merchants and sellers beyond their own existing networks. So expanding into the Amazon network of merchants and sellers. And I guess you could say that for Amazon, it's an opportunity to retain those smaller merchants who may very well be DTC brands in the Amazon marketplace ecosystem, and making sure that they are still, able to make the most of having their products available within the Amazon ecosystem. So really interested to hear what you both think of this. It's interesting to see how Amazon are organizing themselves to make themselves relevant, I suppose, to smaller merchants and retailers, and particularly DTC brands. And I'm also interested in your views on Adobe's positioning here. Is this really actually going to give them the sort of scale that they might be looking for by teaming up with Amazon? Or, you know, is it a little bit of a sort of a misnomer that just because they're going to have their tools available within this particular part of the Amazon marketplace that it will give them bigger share of a customer base? Maya, what's your impression?
Yeah, so I think this is referring to Adobe's acquisition of Magento, which happened earlier this year. I think Adobe paid almost $7 billion for it. So I think this is kind of one of their big first forays into the e-commerce space. And I think it makes sense from an Adobe standpoint. There's, you know, they've got their entire cloud infrastructure from, DSP, DMP, web analytics, and now it makes sense that they're looking at the e-commerce space and acquiring this e-commerce platform.
Yeah. Kieran?
I'm trying to figure out what the sort of the opportunity is here for Adobe. They've got Magento, right? So I'm just trying to figure out why they need Amazon, because Magento is an e-commerce platform. And why would they need Amazon then to
access to customers?
Maybe, but it's just seems to be a bit. I just think this is more of a long, mid to long tail play for Adobe. I mean, maybe Magento is such a it's quite enterprise, and you need to have a certain scale to use it. It's not like here I'm selling a bunch of coats or buttons or whatever you're selling.
Yeah, or really really small specific.
Yeah, or like maybe mid sized. There's a big scrap going on between a lot of these companies for like this. This whole segment of DTCs, right? So obviously Facebook have launched a buy button on Instagram, which I think is in beta at the minute, being tested in the US. So one click to buy. So there's a lot of a lot of scrapping going on for this whole segment of these sort of challenger brands. And maybe this is, I guess maybe this is Adobe's attempt to get them in the door with Amazon. But then as they get bigger and going, you know what, we want to have our own access to first party data. We want to have control over our supply chain. We'll go to Magento after. Maybe it's a stepping stone for them. I just think that, you know, going with Amazon's a funny one. It just makes it easier, I suppose, to get those early doors brands as opposed to getting bigger brands to use the Adobe suite. So, I don't know, it's a funny one. I don't know if it's it's an interesting strategy by Adobe and probably smart, but I think it
gives them a way into e-commerce so that they have more data on from their enterprise kind of cloud aspect, more data to help their clients across, you know, buying from purchase to advertising and using that purchase data or that e-commerce data to influence advertising down the line.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, that's a good point, right? Because they're mostly otherwise probably selling into customers on the basis of sort of marketing technology, marketing tools, but not necessarily in the e-commerce space, right? So, you know, maybe this is their, you know, maybe they see it as their opportunity to really make waves in e-commerce. And I suppose from Amazon's point of view, it potentially also rolls out their branded store environment to a wider range of customers as well, because it might go the other way too.
Look, if I was a DTC, I wouldn't trust Amazon as far as I throw them. I mean, it's a very, very important transactional there, but like the reality is Amazon basically take that data and then they spin up their own white labels and they end up competing with you. Like, so, you know, they have scale, and that is one of the things that Amazon has. And I'm not surprised that Adobe's gone down this route. But ultimately, if you get to a certain size, you want to get it off Amazon. And I think that some brands will never sell at Amazon because of the perception. It's a yellow label platform. If you look at Amazon, it's just a horrible looking experience for me anyway.
Yeah.
And certain brands say, I'm not selling my high end price. It just kind of penalizes sort of the value of that particular product when I sell it on Amazon. So, I don't know.
So, interesting, because on the point about DTC brands maybe not wanting to use Amazon. So, I think about DTC brands, and some of the most successful ones have been category disruptors, right?
Yeah.
So, I think about Casper Mattress, who, you know, the mattress buying experience is awful. Like, you go to a store, you lay down in your clothes on a mattress in front of a bunch of strangers, flop around.
Yeah, it looks a bit
and
odd.
Like, yeah, it's just
what's going
weird.
On?
Well, it's so weird.
It's so comfortable you actually fall asleep, which happened to me once.
No.
So woke me up. Yeah.
I hope you were hungover on a Saturday morning.
I was pretty hungover.
Yeah, that sounds like a creepy thing that would happen to you, Kieran.
That experience.
It's not creepy. These things happen.
That experience coupled with, you know, a 4-week delivery window and then what to do with your mattress afterward. Like, some of the best D2C brands have really disrupted that. So Casper, you know, will deliver to your house within 3 days. You have a beautiful site that will tell you the product specs, help you decide what mattress to buy. And then if you buy it and you don't like it, they make the return really easy, really easy. So, you know, they've done that really well in the D2C space. But I looked on Amazon and you can actually buy a Casper mattress on Amazon as well.
Right.
And to your point, Kieran, the Amazon shopping experience maybe isn't the most aesthetically pleasing, but for me as a consumer, I sort of just default to it sometimes because they have my payment information, they have my address, and it's so easy that I'm happy to make a lot of those purchases through Amazon and not go through another kind of sales channel.
Yeah. And I think that's a really interesting point, Maya, because I find that often I'm using Amazon almost just as a proxy search engine as well, because I'm thinking to myself, I want something. Imagine, you know, it's a mattress and I didn't know about Casper or whatever. Where can I get it? And so I just go to Amazon to type it in just to see what products are available. And I might even, if something interesting comes up, I might even look for it outside of Amazon, maybe just to check other reviews or what their website, what that actual brand or shop website looks like. But people are behaving in all sorts of ways within the Amazon environment that I think enables Amazon to think about new ways to keep people in that environment and new ways to attract people to that environment. And you're right, Kieran, it might not be an attractive shopping experience, but I don't think that really stops people, particularly if it's offering convenience and competitive prices as well. You know, sometimes you'll buy things on Amazon even if it's only a pound or so cheaper than you could get it somewhere else.
I suppose they've perfected the process of buying. I mean,
and that's what a lot of e-commerce players will want access to, right? Which is where branded stores comes in.
But you're still relinquishing a lot of power to Amazon, particularly around first party data. And I think if you're a scaled proposition, I think you need to be thinking about. I mean, okay, the majority of brands. But someone who's using Magento is obviously a potential Amazon competitor, like, you know. You know, they're Amazon's taking revenue off them in some shape or form if they're actually taking percentage of the sale. So, I don't know. It's a good strategy in sense of scale, right? Because nobody can argue with Amazon in the Western world. It has got unbelievable scale in Europe and US. Plus, it has the fulfillment order piece as well, the logistic piece, where you can get delivered to
the door. Which is going to be really important
for
sellers and merchants.
But then it's the trade-off. What are you giving away at the same time to Amazon, which is making them stronger in the advertising business and all the rest of it, you know?
Yeah, but I think the Magento client set, if you will, is a lot of SMEs. So when you're an SME, I don't know how important is giving your data to Amazon versus building your business and bringing in more revenue, and you'll do that through as many channels as you think you need to, right? To build your business and sell your products.
Absolutely. It's exactly the same reason that they will flock to Facebook advertising, because it's easy and it brings in results.
I do think there is probably a point where if you become a massive retailer or a massive kind of product distributor, you might start to pull back and think about what your strategy is on where you give your data. But I think when you're an SME, you're probably focused more on building your business and attracting new customers through whatever kind of relevant channels that brings.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, moving on to the second news story that I wanted to chat with you guys about today. So this is based on, this is an article that The Drum released earlier this week, based on an ASA report in the US, so that's the Advertising Standards Authority in the US, which was talking about the volume of complaints that they're receiving relating to online advertising and how that's far outstripping the level of complaints that they receive relating to TV advertising. And that's a new thing, right? So it used to be the other way around. The report attributes that to a couple of things. First is sort of increased consumer awareness over the ins and outs, shall we say, of online advertising, not least of which is data privacy and regulation. So the idea being that consumers are much more aware of the fact that they do have some, albeit arguably limited, controls over how their data is used. And so that's made them a little bit more aware of online advertising, which therefore has drawn sort of more complaints about perhaps some of the intrusiveness of online advertising. People are much more aware now that influencers ought to be declaring specifically what kind of products they're endorsing and whether they're advertising or not advertising. And as a result, particularly because influencer advertising is so kind of high profile, consumers are coming forward with complaints about where those adverts are appearing and they're not necessarily being declared as adverts. So I'm interested to hear your perspective on this because, you know, we've been talking a lot about TV advertising in general at Exchange Wire and on our podcast the last couple of weeks. We've been talking about, you know, the opportunities within connected TV and therefore the advertising opportunities within connected TV and whether they're kind of keeping pace with the technology that's being developed, whether they're actually, you know, whether advertising that's appearing in a connected TV environment is very targeted or not, and whether that would ultimately achieve this goal of perhaps more relevant and less intrusive advertising. And at the same time, we've got consumers becoming so much more aware of online advertising and that outstripping in terms of complaints what's happening in the TV environment. So I'm interested in your views from that point of, from that perspective. And I'm also interested, it's sort of in a more general capacity, in your views about, you know, the sort of value and value versus intrusiveness of digital advertising and online advertising, and whether the industry is really getting to grips with this or whether we're just kind of moving on to the next distracting big thing. So Maya, let's start with you.
So,
Jesus, Rachel.
It's all right. It happens to me.
Yeah, I just wanted to keep pace with everybody else that's ever interviewed you.
Right. So On this article, I think the first thing I thought about was, like, let's take a step back, and comparing online ads to TV ads is a bit of a apples and oranges comparison. TV ads, the first TV ad ran in 1941, and that format has largely stayed the same. It's been sight, sound, and motion, storytelling of a brand, and that's mostly kind of been the format of TV. Whereas digital, we celebrated, I think this year, the 25-year anniversary of the first digital advert that was ever put on the internet. And that has resulted in such an evolution of different ad formats, you know, and I think we've tried to innovate and try new things, and consumers are experiencing different online adverts, whereas in TV, they're used to just having that sort of video, sight, sound, and motion. They have an expected or an anticipated experience with that, versus online is constantly disrupting, changing the formats, trying something new, etc.
Yeah. Kieran, you're making lots of faces during that.
Bullshit report, hey. It's really real bullshit. I mean, who cares, right? So,
Consumers
well, no,
care.
No, they don't. It's like comparing, I agree with that, about comparing TV to digital is silly.
Apples and oranges.
It's silly. Mm. And then there is clearly a segment within that report around the influencers versus digital advertising, right? So I would say that probably most people are getting pissed off about celebrities endorsing stuff on Instagram. I think that's where the eerie comes from, as opposed to, you know, display ads on a page. Okay, there are instances in certain sites, on mobile sites, where they have some horrible formats and the user experience is terrible, right? Okay. But I think most sites are conscious of that, and hence the reason why they don't run that much ad load on pages anymore.
But there's still some sites that aren't.
This is the problem. Right?
Doing that.
We are so hard on ourselves. It's so I get annoyed.
Do you mean as an industry?
I just get annoyed about the shit that we are taking from all sites, whether it's the privacy nut jobs like Johnny Ryan and all his crew, to this silly, stupid stuff that we have to read. The press just love the press stories. I'm sick of it.
Tell us what you really think, Kieran.
No, I'm just saying, look, there's a trade-off here, right? You get free shit, you should see some ads, right? We are not doing, as an industry, doing a good job of articulating. We're almost scared of our own bloody shadow at the minute, right? Mm. How did a piece of JavaScript become an evil thing in the space? I don't understand it.
So to your point, I do think consumers care because they're installing ad blockers, right? And that is decreasing year over year. Mm. But I think there's also been some work that's done by the Coalition for Better Ads to actually survey users. So they surveyed 66,000 consumers to find out what advertising formats they found acceptable, and they found intuitive and not intrusive. Mm. And so the Coalition for Better Ads has kind of built this framework of acceptable ads. And that's now made it into trade organizations. So the IAB Gold Standard, that's one of the fundamental principles of the IAB Gold Standard, which is, you know, a UK initiative. But this Coalition for Better Ads has kind of been adopted across markets. So I do actually think that consumers care because they wouldn't be installing ad blockers if they didn't. And there is an industry initiative around creating better ad formats that are more intuitive and non-intrusive for consumers. So it's kind of reversing that.
Well, look, I agree with that. And the initiatives done by the trade bodies and all those involved is very important, right? But we still are doing a terrible job of talking about the value exchange, right?
Yeah.
You start doing, like, it takes an awful lot of resource, financial, human resource to build content on websites. You have to monetize that way. And, like, despite what all these trades say that subscriptions are the way forward, most people can't afford to have 100,000 subscriptions, right? We only have so much money, right? You know, either to go on holidays in Malta, you know, or just to go to the pub and have a pint after work. We have to have discretionary income for other areas, right? So ads are the only way to fund this internet. And I think that the stuff that you know, we're talking about here, the Coalition for Better Ads is a great initiative because actually we should engage users. And I'm not saying that users don't matter. That's not what I'm saying at all. What I'm trying to say is that we are not doing a great job of articulating the value.
Yeah, the value exchange.
The value exchange.
And arguably that is part of what Coalition for Better Ads is aiming for as well, right? Yeah. It's talking about, it's trying to start that conversation with consumers and users about advertising, where it appears, what the point of it is, where the value exchange is, and then get some honest feedback about what is where that's best placed from a consumer point of view, right?
Yeah, I think that the Coalition for Better Ads is really focused around finding the right formats that will, you know, create a better user, a better consumer experience so that value exchange is more acceptable and they're not doing things like installing ad blockers and understanding that. I agree with you, Kieran. I think the internet is free. Like, you could walk into a library as your other source of free information, right? Mm-hmm. Like, nobody's going to do that.
No.
So you should definitely continue to be receptive to advertising online and ensure that that's part of your kind of that value exchange is part of your understanding as a consumer that this content costs money for editorial staff, for videographers, etc.
And there should be some kind of, I agree, there's been a lot of taking advantage of users in many ways, like the use of data and sort of the amount of ads on a page that crashes either the phone they're on or destroys the user experience, right? But there's a halfway house here, and I feel that the industry is almost apologetic for serving ads on the site in the first place. You've got to kind of stop this expectant free culture, like freeloading culture, because if you don't take it head on, there is no internet. There is no ad-funded internet. Like, most people just won't bother doing content. It'll be subscriptions everywhere. And let's be honest, there'll only be a handful of publications left, and it would probably destroy the richness of the internet and information being free. It's not free. There is a cost behind it, and ads are the best way to do that. And I think that we need to push back a little bit. Mm. Where I completely understand about taking the user's point on board and the ad blockers. Think if someone's using an ad blocker, I'm glad, because we're asking, why are you using the ad blocker? Because I'm sick of seeing all these pop-ups, or sick of all these rich media ads destroying my user experience on the page, and all I want to do is read the content. But if you explain to the user that, you know, these ads help to support the people who actually produce the content. And I feel that message is not being said properly by the leading trade bodies. Well, we're actually on the defensive completely. And I think we need to kind of push back.
Do you think maybe that also that message needs to be articulated eloquently from the point of view of content producers as well? Because they are sort of struggling with, you know, a variety of monetization models. So many, you know, content providers are looking at setting up subscription models, but also have ad-funded businesses as well. And that can be a bit of a confusing proposition, I suppose, to articulate to a consumer. But do you think that you know, publishers and content providers need to also be responsible for articulating the value in that as well? What'd you say, Mark?
Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
I would say, I think they have a huge role in that. And I also think that 100% ad-funded model is probably not the best business strategy. A lot of content producers are, you know, they have a diversified business strategy for their revenue. It's not 100% ad funding. It might be subscriptions. It might be other ventures in other areas. So I think, you know, that is got to be something that the content producers are doing for their business. But I don't think you can rely 100% on advertising all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Kieran?
You have to have a diversified business for sure. I think, you know, you could have a mix of paid ad funded events. You know, you got to look at some of the stuff, the DTC stuff, selling products. Modern publishers have to be diversified, but
well, for,
you know,
many reasons as well, right?
But if you have a scale proposition, ads are a good way to run your business. There's plenty of examples of publishers who have very, very scaled businesses, probably light on the resource piece, but still have decent businesses where ads are actually funding the whole business. I could, you know, it's not just text publishers, but you think about gaming and utility sites, they are completely dependent on ads for their revenue. So you know, but there is in the modern publisher, like it's, I mean, the Guardians and the Telegraph will have to have a diversified portfolio of revenue opportunities. Yeah.
And changing tack for a moment, notwithstanding the really good point, Maya, that you made at the start of this, which was, you know, you can't compare TV advertising and online display advertising; they're two completely different things. What about the TV industry, though, and its advertising opportunity? I'm just interested to know both of your perspectives on whether we will achieve that kind of holy grail of more targeted, relevant advertising, and how different is that going to be in a TV environment as opposed to an online, you know, digital display environment? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the targetability of TV is growing. And going back a bit in terms of what... one thing that the online industry from the advertising standpoint doesn't have that TV does have is, at least in the UK, Clearcast approval for creative, going back to the point about whether or not consumers are interacting or wanting ads. So that's a completely different way of operating in TV, where every creative advert that gets distributed goes through this Clearcast approval process and is checked for a number of different factors.
Standards,
yeah, exactly. Standards. Whereas in digital, you don't really have that. I mean, you have in programmatic exchanges check the creative to make sure the links work, kind of, maybe. but that just that there's no body that does that, which is just a completely different.
It'd be pretty difficult
approach.
To kind of preview trillions of ads every month.
None of bandwidth.
You know.
Yeah, yeah. What do you think, Kieran?
About what?
TV.
I love it. I watch a lot of TV.
Is it going to produce better ads?
There's nothing wrong with TV ads.
I mean, in the future.
I mean, look at TV ads are great. I mean, they're little movies when they're done right. You know, I love advertising. I don't care what anybody says. It's great. I mean, you're getting free content, you know. On to the next story.
I mean, well, I was going to say, like, there's an expected 25 million UK OTT consumers, according to ComScore, in 2019, sorry. So I think this is a definite growing area. There's still some limitations in the space of connected TV in terms of targetability, what you can do with it. Clash management, which exists in TV, is a bit more difficult in CTV. You basically have to go down to supply path optimization down to who hosts the ads in order to navigate that effectively. I think that there's a lot of promising stats coming out of connected TV. So we see a 90% view-through rate on connected TV. And, you know, the targeting is limited still, with a lot of ROS being kind of the standard.
Yeah.
And we're seeing that verification, which is a big thing. Every time something comes into the digital space, you've got to verify it, you've got to measure it. And verification isn't really coming until later this year, sounds like.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you imagine that verification would be pretty easy in TV, in that, you know, most people see the ads.
I'm talking about connected TV. Yeah.
Oh, okay, right. Okay, interesting. Is that connected TV then... this also kind of counting Netflix and Amazon Prime, or is it just...
So it would be advertising opportunities through connected TV devices. Yeah, okay. could be those, could be Roku, could be, you know, a number of different OTT providers.
Yeah.
Okay.
Interesting. Helpful segue.
I was just thinking that. The last story is about TV.
No, helpful segue into the second part of the chat, which is a bit more of a focus. We've just had the last story on TV, Kieran. A bit more of a focus on what Maya's working on over at OMGP. Did I get that right?
Yeah, Omnicom Media Group Programmatic UK.
Would that be OMG? Hold on. P-U-K.
No, don't. Don't play with this any further, Kieran.
Okay.
It's taken us a while to get to this point. So, you know, we've got Maya's name right. We've got the acronym right.
You got it wrong.
Things are going well. Things are going well. So, I wanted to open up the conversation to have a little bit more of a discussion with you, Maya, about what you're working on at Omnicom. And also, you know, you mentioned a couple of things when we were prepping for this that you're particularly interested in. One of them was around programmatic supply chain. So I thought maybe we could start with that since you've just mentioned that.
Yeah, sure.
Tell us a bit about what you're working on in that field. And also you can tell us a little bit about the area that you're focusing on within the agency and how it's and how the programmatic business is couched within the group.
Yeah, so we, as in OMG Programmatic in the UK, we operate across all of the different agency groups within Omnicom Media Group. And so we have a central unit that focuses on sort of product development, establishing best practice, and then we have the activation happening within the agencies specifically. So we have a hub and spoke model, if you will. So I sit on the OMGP team, and historically, I started around 5 years ago curating supply, working with publishers and exchange and SSP partners, and have kind of evolved into a number of different areas. And supply chain optimization is definitely one of those areas. So we've had a number of kind of initiatives over the past few years on trying to create the best and most effective route to market. And we've done a pretty good job of it, seeing, you know, results that when we've been are benchmarked against our peers are more beneficial on a cost perspective. And we're also enabling that direct route to publisher. I think the one of the most interesting areas in this is what we're doing with the government. So and I can't speak too much about it yet, but we're really scrutinizing the entire programmatic supply chain and taking a look at all the intermediaries involved, kind of shaking the model on its head a little bit and reevaluating how we engage with them. So we have a big project around that that we are hoping to have more news on later this year, but are really excited about really cleaning up the ecosystem and creating transparency from client side all the way through to the publisher.
Yeah, and when you say you're working with the government on that, you mean...
Government's one of our clients.
As a client, yeah.
Right. Out of MG, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that would be really interesting when that info becomes available.
Do you use ads.txt at all to sort of verify sellers and resellers of specific inventory? Obviously now, it's become like, obviously, DVD... Is it DV360? I can't even remember what...
Yep, that's
Google
it.
Keeps calling the products. DV360 have said that they're only buying... ads.txt
inventory.
Yeah. So is that something you sort of rely heavily on or?
Yeah. So before DV360 made that announcement, you could target only ads.txt verified sellers. So that's been something that we've been doing for over a year now. So that is one part of it, but also even within verified ads.txt sellers, there's probably optimal supply paths, not all of them. So if you look at some publishers, will have 20 different resellers. Some will have, I think the most I've seen is 180. And so you still need to know how to navigate within that. So it's not a all one size fits all. Ads.txt fixes it all. It's a big help. But I think if you want to be smarter about how you buy, navigating within those verified resellers is important too.
Good.
Yeah. Also, you were talking a little bit about your approach to working with clients in a general capacity when we were chatting about this podcast as well.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell me a little bit more about what you're focusing on there at the moment?
Yeah. So we've taken our programmatic expertise and kind of we're evolving the way that we're engaging with clients. And I think agencies have struggled with this. And what we're doing is taking a more consultative approach in many aspects. And, you know, engaging with the clients on what are their business challenges and how can we solve them, not just plan and buy media. So one of the things we've done is we've built a custom algorithm for a client using their first party conversion data to optimize to viewable conversions. And this sounds like pretty much a no-brainer, but obviously if an impression isn't viewable, then it shouldn't be attributed to a conversion. But that doesn't always stop the ad server from actually counting that conversion to a non-viewable impression. So we worked with the client to establish a kind of pipe into their first-party conversion data and built a algorithm on top of an existing DSP that really optimized to what they are seeing in terms of viewable conversions. And the results were pretty staggering. We were able to double the return on ad spend. And had a 65% incremental revenue for the business. So that sort of thinking, I think, is really needed in the agency space. And we're seeing clients that are coming to us with some more business challenges, and we're finding different ways to solve them.
And does that inform your process then? You talk about consultants, you talking to your clients, which is an informed product like this. So this product probably wasn't built initially or previously or standardized, but
it's completely bespoke for that client. Yeah.
But then that helps you with other clients as well to build something similar with other clients, because that informs the process of building product.
It informs the process. It's not a copy and paste though, because it's based on specific client data,
individual client. Yeah. It's really interesting though, Maya, because we spend a lot of time at Exchange by talking about the service layer, business models in general. So agency business model, how consultancies have been working together directly with brand clients to sort of assess their needs. And then we also spend quite a lot of time speaking with brand clients directly to ask them how they're organizing their media buying capabilities and their programmatic capabilities. So that's a really interesting example because, you know, we have so many brand clients saying to us, well, actually, we find it's really important to just work more and more closely with our agency and to open up that communication. So this seems like an example of where a client has already perhaps got an existing good relationship with you guys, but said, look, this is what's giving us a headache. And you've actually approached that, like you say, from a consultative point of view and thought, okay, well, instead of just sort of getting something off the shelf that we would normally try to sort of apply in this situation, let's actually work in more detail with the client to see if we can come up with a bespoke solution.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think client trust is the first part of the equation. And then once that's established, you can better solve some of their business challenges and they'll take you along on their journey. And we can take our thinking from, years of buying programmatic media and apply that to their business and drive true results from it.
Yeah. And what about from a tech point of view? So in that particular example, did you work together with an existing tech partner to provide that add-on or?
Yeah. So that was actually an alpha product from one of our existing DSPs. So it's worth noting, we don't own a DSP. We license existing DSPs in market. And we have a software engineering team who they are just absolutely brilliant. They build products on top of existing DSPs. And so like one thing that they've built in the past year is a QA bot. So when all of the kind of brand safety issues were happening, we doubled down to say, everybody who sets up a campaign needs to make sure that all of their brand safety segments are applied. They have an inclusion list applied. Dot the T's. No.
You could if you wanted. That'd be a different language. Yeah.
So they built a QA bot that basically looks into the existing DSPs and will analyze if something is not applied right. It takes our best practice setup, analyzes what's happened in the DSP and flag issues to the user if something's not done correctly. So like they're just innovating on top of existing tech, which I think gives us an advantage because we're not using necessarily an off-the-shelf DSP all the time.
Mm. And that's your own in-house team that are doing that extra
innovation.
Yeah,
they literally sit in the same bank of decks as me.
Just one thing.
Too loud for them.
you had a lot of programmatic teams in the past or kind of were basically hived into the sort of companies, but they talk a lot of the buys in themselves and that executed. But I get the sense that your current layout is to working hand in hand with a lot of the planner buyers across the group in Europe, and that's the way you kind of integrated that know-how into their daily sort of activities.
Yeah, exactly. So we used to have that hub that all the activation happened through a central team, and then we scaled up to be big enough and realized that we needed to distribute that expertise into the agencies, get them closer to clients. And so we've done that and it's worked really well. Each of the agencies takes a slightly different approach. So we kind of centrally evaluate that and share best practice across the group so that everybody can kind of learn and make sure that they're, having the most progressive campaign setup, the most progressive way of going about supply path optimization and so on.
Great. And then you were also keen to tell us a little bit about what you're working on from an audio point of view. That's another thing that we're often talking about is here at Exchange Wire is sort of, you know, we keep referring to them as alternative programmatic mm-hmm. channel or alternative channels, and then the potential value of programmatic within that.
Right.
It feels like audio is kind of quite fast in a way from a consumer point of view becoming mainstream, but
yeah.
it's probably still very much developing in the world of programmatic tech. I don't know. Tell us what you're
I would
to.
Actually say we feel like it's pretty developed. There's new formats and such that are being developed, but we launched our first programmatic audio, like truly programmatic, using RTB, not just buying something and calling it a day. like truly programmatic RTB in 2016. And so since then, we've been kind of building our audio product. We had a 56% year-over-year growth. That was on a pretty big base already. And so we're seeing innovation in the podcasting space where Ooh, we're programmatically... Podcast. Yeah, I know. Maybe you guys should look into that. where we are programmatically inserting ads into podcasts as well as streaming audio content and even new and interesting formats such as in-car. So messaging programmatically in car, as well as connected speakers. Mm. So this space is like massively growing, and you know we're also working on establishing different creative formats where you can not only have an audio experience in your ears, but you can also have an experience on your mobile device that's connected to audio. So that is something that I think is pretty established from. Our standpoint.
Are you, so just talk about audio, are you taking existing creative from the radio buyers and then repurposing it for these channels like podcasts and the likes of Spotify and Pandora and all the rest? Is that how you're doing it, or and are you kind of informing the radio audio buyers, existing radio buyers in Omnicom about how this could work? I mean, I'm just curious, how does that spill over from traditional radio buying into sort of the programmatic era? Is there kind of a crossover, or is there like a digital team that just does this only? I'm just, because obviously there must be some kind of like clashing of heads sometimes around some of this stuff.
Well, I would say that the AV teams or the audio teams within the agencies are. You know, they're well aware of where consumers are just as much as anybody. So they're seeing digital audio being a bigger play and an increasing space. So I don't know that there's as much clashing of the heads as you might want there to be, Kieran.
I don't. I'm looking
for a fight.
I'm not looking for punch-ups. But I just think that there's an awful lot of lines being crossed within the agencies between traditional channels like digital TV, radio, at a home, even like, you know, the programmatic is sort of threading a lot of these together, and inevitably there's encroachment happening on different teams. I'm just wondering how a big holding group deals with that.
So we have our central team who looks after programmatic audio, for example, and they'll be into the agencies talking about what's on the roadmap, doing roadshows, what's the latest offering. And their audience is oftentimes radio buyers, right? So the radio teams also will be working to look at the digital space just as much as traditional radio. So on the creative front, there's probably a mixture to your first question of existing radio assets that get repurposed to use online, sort of like TV does in video. But there's also increasingly dynamic audio ad insertion. So that is something that's really interesting, where you can actually change the creative. It's fragmented and then it dynamically is inserted into your audio experience programmatically.
How do you measure it, though? I'm just curious. I always kind of I love these new channels. I go, how do you measure the ROI on radio, or sorry, audio?
Yeah, so it's often a listen-through rate, which is sort of the same as video. You would look at your video completion rate. Mm-hmm. And there's also an increase in footfall. So for some clients who have a retail store, we can look at an uptick in footfall within the programmatic audio impact. So how much increase is there to test drive a car or visit your favorite
supermarket or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. Exactly.
Yeah. The attribution models around audio must be interesting then. You know, it must be quite
opportunity
fun,
there.
Fun building those type of tools for the clients.
What's the demand like from clients then for audio?
I think we're seeing more and more interest because, you know, if you look at consumer behaviors, it's going more and more into digital audio, and those formats are even changing between, you know, 2 years ago, connected speakers weren't
quite
too
rapid.
Big, but that growth chart is pretty steep. So, the users are there, so you'd want to be there from an advertiser standpoint.
Yeah. Awesome. All right. Well, we've pretty much run out of time. So thank you very much, Maya, for coming in and chatting with
thank
us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Maya.
We don't get awful lot of agency guests, so it's really nice to have you here. And also thanks for squeezing us in before you jet set off on holes.
Yeah, have a good time.
Thank you.
Awesome. And that was this week's MadTech Podcast.